The story of today's Haiti begins with the arrival of the first European expedition into the New World to the Europeans. Christopher Columbus in 1492 accidentally landed on the eastern side of the island of Hispaniola. This discovery marked the beginning of the end for the indigenous people on this island. The original inhabitants in present-day Dominican Republic and Haiti quickly died from disease, enslavement, and war in one generation. For 300 years, European powers abused the land and the people they extracted from Africa to work the land. Another colleague of mine on the trip describes the history this way. Those who survived the journey to the New World provided the power to pull plows, to clear fields and to harvest sugarcane, to cut the timber, to build the fires that boiled the cane, distilling it into the liquid gold of rum, a product that brought so much wealth to the French colonizers and yet harsh conditions to the slaves who tilled the land and toiled in the fields and the distilleries. As they cut the forest and fed the fires, another fire began to grow in the hearts of those suffering people. It burst forth in a series of bold slave rebellions. These were suppressed harshly, yet the fire could not be extinguished. Finally, in 1804, the rebellious slaves drove the French oppressors into the sea. The audacious idea of a black lead land was not received well in the global community. So for 200 years, there was marginalization, isolation, and manipulation of the people in that country. This is what I discovered when I was doing research, preparing for my own option to make a difference when I was about 10 years ago. It was a medical mission in 2001. I was and still am, a lifelong Unitarian Universalist. I grew up with a strong commitment to make a difference in the world. I was a medic in the Army, so I had advanced EMT skills that I could actually share with these people and put them to good use. In my training, I came across some folks and got connected to this group that would spend a week in Haiti to provide medical services for those folks. So I jumped at the chance. After all, it's an opportunity to make a difference, right? So as the story goes, we were there for 5 days. We turned away more people than we could serve. We did the best that we could. I participated in the trip fully, and I intended to not really get anything out of it. I was there to serve them. I was there to make a difference in their world. Well, when I returned to the U.S., I discovered something. It hit me when I came into Miami International Airport and went into the bathroom, and I turned on the faucet. And if water came out, which shouldn't be surprising, but the fact that I could drink that water, or I could make it any temperature that I wanted to, I haven't been able to do that for the past week. And so it hit me, wow, this is a blessing that I live in a place where I can get drinkable water out of the faucet. This was normal. And yet, what did I do to earn it? Nothing. I just had this privilege of being in the United States where this was commonplace. I wanted to change the world, but instead, I ended up changing myself. I didn't think that I would ever be able to see the world the same way, and I haven't since then. I've always kept that understanding of privilege in my own life, and I'm truly grateful for that gift. A few years later, I heard a calling to ordained ministry, so I started the ultra-slow process of part-time education at Meadville Lombard Theological School, one of our Unitarian Universalist schools. I'm still on that track, and I have no idea when I'll be done. But in the winter intensive classes of 2010, we were with fellow students, and not too far away, exactly. The earth shook. The capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince, which has half of the people who live in that country, got an almost direct hit with a 7.0 earthquake. My heart sank. The images were coming in The news footage was just bad news after bad news. I shared my story with my classmates to encourage them for an outpouring of financial support, because it seemed that's all that we could do taking these classes in Chicago. We couldn't go anywhere. There wasn't really any other options that we had, so maybe financial support is what we could do. Well, the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee, which helps us live out our values in the world, and the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations collectively got together and they said, why don't we be a place for Unitarian Universalists and others to donate money so that we can be good stewards of how that gets used in that country? Because what the service committee does is they realize that when large organizations like the Red Cross come in to do disaster work and to do relief work, there tends to be people who are left out, people who are marginalized, people for one reason or another just don't get the benefits, the services that they need. So the service committee does a good job of focusing in on them to see what they can do. The other thing that the service committee does is it doesn't tell them what they need, and it doesn't just provide them things that they don't ask for. They actually partner with them. They do this in what they call an eye-to-eye relationship, where they literally are eye-to-eye, face-to-face with the people that are going to be receiving whatever thing that the service committee can provide. It's in relationships that the organizations in Haiti that the service committee supports can do their work. We already know they're doing good work, and they're doing it at a local level. We don't have to reinvent or come up with some brand new system here. But it took about 18 months after the earthquake for the service committee to actually send a team of medical professionals, some are mental health and some were not, to the capital to do some work for the organizations that they were partnering with. And shortly after that, we partnered with an organization that had been around for 36 years now. A man named Siobhan Jean-Baptiste moved from the city when he was young to the Papaye region of Haiti. He found many subsistence farmers, those that work the earth to feed themselves. They don't do it in a large way. They just do it to feed their own family. They were suffering from smaller and smaller crops each year. That's still common today because a lot of farmers believe that it's their fault. God doesn't believe that they have enough faith, and therefore they're not getting the food that they need, and the earth isn't providing for them the way that it ought to. Well, Siobhan, being an agriculturalist, knew that actually it had pretty much everything to do with poor farming techniques. There are certain ways that you rotate crops, and you don't cut down all the trees so that the good nutrient-rich soil doesn't wash away with the rain. So he knew these things, and he knew that these generations of subsistence farmers really unknowingly were making their own life worse. So together with a local Catholic priest, they called a meeting, and 40 folks showed up. They encouraged those farmers to take an active role in changing their own circumstances. If they worked together, they could engage in a collective effort to educate themselves and change their own ways. Then life could be better for them. That was the start. The next time they had a meeting, only 14 of those original 40 came back. However, it grew. Today it has 1,600 small groups with over 100,000 engaged, participating peasants. And a peasant in this country is someone who doesn't live in a city, they work on the land, so it doesn't necessarily have to do with their economic status. It has more to do with how they feed themselves and take care of themselves. This organization, the Papaye Peasant Movement, abbreviated MPP, it provides a diverse array of services. They have a training center where they have a radio station and an internet cafe, an electric generator, a dining hall and classrooms, and even barracks for students to come from across the country, sometimes from across the world, to get training, to learn how to do this work together and to learn how to be good farmers. They have engineers there. They have all sorts of trade skills to helping these people work collectively to get something done. the service committee asked MPP, what would be the most useful thing that we could do? We've got a bunch of money and we're partnering with you. What is it that would help the most amount of people or help them in the most significant way, those that were displaced from the earthquake? The answer to that was, well, let's create a sustainable, long-lasting, collaborative solution. Sounds good, right? Right? Yeah. Well, they actually did it. They said, well, there's going to be people who might go back, but those that want to stay here, those that want to live in the Central Plateau, those that want to become farmers and learn the skills that we've been teaching for decades, those that want to be a part of this community, be in relationship with MPP, those folks we will help provide a home for. Not just a home, but a home among other homes where collectively, almost like a co-op, these folks work together to make their own food, to grow their own food, and to specialize sometimes in the different skills required to hold the business or do whatever it takes to live in that type of community. Part of this opportunity that the service committee has with MPP led us to have the option for what we call work camps. It's a time for ordinary people, people of faith from the U.S., to put in a physical contribution there on the ground. Except for the two medical groups, the first work camp that was organized with MPP and the steering committee was restricted to seminarians. I guess seminarians were more expendable if something went wrong. I'm not quite sure. Well, I was a seminarian, still am, and I had a fondness for Haiti because of my past experience, and I still possess these critical medical skills in case we ever needed them, and I also developed construction skills over the years, so I thought I could do a lot of good there. I would have a lot to contribute. Well, I interviewed with them to just for them to get to know me, but I also wanted to make sure that they knew I've already had my transformation experience. I'm already changed from my first trip. So if there's someone else who hasn't been before who wants to go, I want them to have that opportunity because I'm already changed. I'm already changed, right? Well, I first thought that something was up when they said, well, Andrew, it's okay that you've had that experience because this is something different. You're going to experience something new here because this time you're with seminarians and this time there's going to be theological reflection and discussion around your experience. Well, I thought that was a great thing. When I got there, I ended up being faced with a total embarrassment of my own authenticity. I thought I had it all figured out. I thought I was already changed. I thought that this seasoned veteran in the group was the one to dispense knowledge and wisdom to the others. I thought I had very little to gain from this experience. I was wrong. See, my last trip was full of medical professionals, and we didn't talk about our feelings. We didn't discuss the plight of the poverty around us or the social conditions that were keeping it there. We didn't even discuss the toll it might have on us when we return home. I think because we had a home, Haiti was not our world. It was easier for me to disassociate, to put that experience as, well, that's there, and I'm here now. But there was a difference. There's a very little chance that you can go through something like this without being changed. I was grateful for the gift that I had the first time around, but there was something else I was going to get this second time. This was last May in 2011, and I allowed myself to really be present in that space. It took a couple days. I still was thinking, oh, I know everything, right? And I was still thinking that I don't know these other folks quite well yet, so I'd still need to get to know them, and I don't quite get what we're doing here, the work that we're doing, so let me figure that out. So it took a couple days for me to finally get comfortable. But once I did, I allowed myself to be with 9 other Unitarian Universalist seminarians. I was experiencing something very different than I had before. It was here with these folks. It was a religious community where I was truly transformed. It took a lot for me to get there. I later recognized that what had happened was I let go of my own individuality. My own thinking that I can do it alone, that I could be both fully present and in the moment, when the reality is I couldn't be. So I had to put myself, really be vulnerable with these shared experiences with my colleagues. So I let go of my own anxiety that would look foolish, or that I thought I would look foolish, or that I would come off as some imposter to them, or that I was able to create a pathway for a fuller experience. Like, I just had to let that go, and I had to allow myself to be there, be with them, and be open to change. I was finally able to see more than just the misery around me once I allowed myself to be there. I actually realized that the folks that live and work with MPP, their lives are changing dramatically with the work that's happening there, completely unrelated to us. That there was hope that there was a better way of living, a more sustainable way of living was available to them. That when this community pulls together, they can help each other get past their superstitions and make a better life for themselves and their families. I couldn't see that before. I can see it now. I was able to see that among all the poverty, there was actually a large amount of beauty as well. We attended a worship service on Sunday, and it was beautiful. There was a richness of life that I had not allowed myself to see before. I could see the true sustainability all around us as well. One of our projects is to take an old tire, you cut off one of the sidewalls and then flip it inside out. It's a lot harder than you think. And you put a board down there and some sand and then some really rich soil. And for these families, instead of growing food in the ground that can get disease and not get enough water and animals can come by, this they can put up on a platform so that it doesn't get disease and it grows really fast and a lot of food. And one of these tires can actually feed a whole family with some to spare to sell it at market. That's a sustainable way of living. They had sustainability with equipment as well. I made a mistake. I thought I was smart because I knew everything, right? I had this utility knife, one of those razor blade knives, and I brought it, but I knew that it wouldn't last very long there because they probably didn't have a hardware store that they could go to buy extra razor blades. So I bought 100 razor blades that this tool would last them some years. Well, as soon as I got there, they pretty much had these big machetes and had a file. And when that machete got dull, they just filed it and it became razor sharp again. It's not the world that I live in, but it works. It's a sustainable tool, and that was just one of many different places that they found sustainability in their resources. Another was to not use seeds that come from big manufacturers like Monsanto. Some of those seeds will actually, they won't reproduce themselves, so you have to buy them every year. And even if they do reproduce themselves, many of them require petrochemicals as fertilizers, and many of them require pesticides to keep them clean. And the folks here actually believe and have decided that it's better for them to use a sustainable crop, even if it yields a little bit less, but it's more sustainable. They are always going to have that. They're always going to have the seeds, and they don't require all of this other stuff to buy from someone else. Now, I'm not a gardener, but I've been in some circles where people have been discussing sustainability in their own gardens and in their own lives. For many of us in this room, if not even all of us, it's an option. We choose to do it because we can. We have the resources to do that. Well, for the peasants in the Central Plateau, and really all over Haiti and in most of the world, sustainability isn't an option or a luxury. It's a necessity. In letting go of my own Lone Ranger spirit, I was able to get much more out of my experience there. It also allowed me to give more to my fellow travelers, my fellow seminarians. Being more of myself and more vulnerable to them enriched their experience. It fed them spiritually. There's still one thing that was bugging me and several of the others even though the service committee has a good relationship and does a good job representing the donors, some of which are in this room, and I thank you if you made a donation, they represent the donors to have a relationship with these organizations so that good work can be done. Well, that's an institutional relationship, and it was working. But as far as us on the ground working with these folks, I mean, we were building a physical foundation for one of these houses, but we were kind of bad at it. And it wasn't even that hard. We were moving rocks and digging ditches. We moved a lot of rocks and dug a lot of ditches. But the reality is that the amount of money we spent on just getting there easily could have hired folks who were local to do that work. So why were we there? It was a question that we had to ourselves. Really, I don't think any of us voiced it until the very end when we were having a discussion with the founder of this group, Siobhan. And the founder, he had a response for us when we asked him, what is it that our presence actually did for you and actually did for MPP? Of course, I was anticipating that a polite smile would come across his face and he would say, well, you weren't too much in the way. But he didn't. He said, our presence at MPP allowed them to give back to the steering committee. See, a true relationship is a two-way street. You actually give and take. And if the steering committee only gave, that wouldn't really be a relationship. So MPP has this unique opportunity to provide a transformational experience for people like myself to go to this place and experience a completely different way that the world works. He followed up by saying there was another benefit. It may be a little bit smaller, but a real benefit to them. In that culture, I'm going to use his words here, in the way that they were brought up, white people don't do manual labor. They work in offices, and they've got professional jobs. They just don't do manual labor. And we were doing manual labor while we were there. So he said that this helped his folks see a new way that blacks and whites could interact with each other, that the stereotypes that they grew up with weren't necessarily true. And he thanked us for that. The week ended, and our presence was felt, and we felt the presence of the folks that we were with. We ended with a dance party. They wanted us to continue to send folks to get this kind of experience. So the steering committee still works with them. There are groups that are still going. There was a youth and young adult group that went back in August, and I believe there's other groups that are scheduled and probably even some others that have gone. But the service committee can provide something like this to those that are seeking to have a life transformed. And you don't have to be a seminarian either. They focus on this eye-to-eye partnership. I came to realize that although on my own spiritual journey, I'm not going to get very far without a spiritual community to engage with. I receive support from them, and that's what these seminarians provided me in this space. So I'm going to ask you to reflect for a moment. What could you let go? What could you allow yourself to let go to be more fully part of this spiritual community or whatever spiritual community you may belong to? What secrets do you have that you just don't feel like you can tell anyone else? What part of your life have you just been dealing with all on your own, not able to share it with others? I conclude with an excerpt from A House for Hope. These parts were written by Rebecca Parker. There is no life apart from life together. In many Buddhist traditions, taking refuge in the Sangha, the spiritual community, is necessary for enlightenment. These may be startling claims if you've been steeped in a dominant U.S. culture of individualism, which suggests that looking out for number one is the way to survive. But life is relational through and through. Everything exists in interaction and interdependence with everything else. The question is not whether we are social connected beings. That's a given. The question is how we shape our models of being with one another and with the sources that uphold and sustain life. The perils of religious community have left many liberals and progressives convinced that organized religious communities cannot be trusted. They pose too many dangers and break too many promises. Many liberals, conscious or not, seem to prefer that their religious institutions remain weak, underfunded, and distracted by endless attention to process and checks on the excess of power. Too much money, too much power, or organization is feared. It will lead to corruption. That's what some folks think. While congregations can provide an embodied experience of covenant and community among people, they can foster freely chosen and life-sustaining independence. When religious communities are formed by the will of the people themselves and governed by the members, they can be liberating and life-giving places. This is the notion of covenanted community. Much in our dominant culture can lull people into numbness and complacency or compliance. Staying awake, becoming active rather than passive in the world requires something more of us, something we cannot do alone. Religious communities can enable people to claim and deepen the values that the dominant culture is ignoring and denying. They can convert us from lifestyles that disregard the earth and are heedless of the environmental damage and danger we are courting, to lifestyles of reverence and gratitude that enable us to be less materialistic and more attentive to the goodness of life's intangibles. They can free us from consuming unsatisfying intellectual junk food and give us a deep nourishment through the bread and wine of spiritual traditions, sacred texts, intellectual quests, meditations, and prayer. This is how churches, synagogues, sanghas, and mosques make home a place for hope. Their sheltering walls offer us a way of living that finds joy and meaning in each other. In simpler ways of being, in slowing down, and in giving time to the things that matter most, they enable us to create a good life together, a community of resilience, a covenant of joyful interdependence that will support us through the radical changes needed in U.S. society as we embrace the calling to live peacefully and sustainably on this earth. Let it be so.